Hello, heroes, and welcome to Backstory. I'm your host, Alex Roberts. Heroes, I am back from Living Games, and it was amazing. Huge thanks to everyone who worked so hard and so thoughtfully to put together what was a pretty incredible conference. I had fascinating conversations with LARPrights, designers, organizers, researchers, practitioners, and teachers from all over the world doing all different kinds of LARP, and I feel so lucky that I'm going to get to continue and share those conversations with all of you here on the show. So look forward to that. And if you're going to Gen Con 2016, the schedule of events I'm putting on with the Industry Insider program is now live. If you'd like to learn about LARP, podcasting, sex in RPGs, and making gaming more welcoming to newcomers, I would love to see you there. You can find the complete schedule on Gen Con's website under Seminars. I am also going to be working with the good folks at Games On Demand to help organize LARPs On Demand at Gen Con. I've spoken to so many people who would love to try LARPing, and Games On Demand is a friendly, welcoming, totally low-stakes opportunity to give it a shot. If you're interested, I strongly encourage you to pre-register for one of our time slots on the Gen Con schedule site. Just search for LARPs On Demand. Now, today's episode, I have writer and game designer Kira Magran on to talk about cyborg feminism, the mystical digital, and her new zine, Resistor. The audio is going to be a tiny bit dicey in parts, and I do apologize for that, but I promise you the content is well worth it.
Similar to that situation.
Not problem.
Cool. So, what are we going to talk about? Is it a surprise?
I think we should talk about cyber witchcraft. I would like that to be the bulk of today's discussion, because I just finished reading Resistor today, actually, and it was very exciting, and it was very interesting, and I got super, super excited about the emoji sigil rose. Please tell our listeners what the emoji sigil rose is, because I'll just get all excited and squeaky if I try to do it.
Totally. The emoji sigil rose is a game that I designed for the zine that me and my friend Alyssa just put out. Called Resistor, and it is, what did I do? It's based off of, like, an actual sigil maker rose. I can't remember. I'm a terrible magic person. It's, like, Western magic something something.
It's a broad tradition.
Yeah, right? And depending on how new age it is, it steals from a bunch of stuff, but, which is another interesting topic. But the emoji rose, you, like, connect these different emojis about how you're feeling in a straight line. Well, not a straight line. A squiggly line, and then it creates a sigil for that you can cast magic spells with. So if you're feeling sick, you can make a sad emoji with an emoji of soup and an emoji of friends and sleep, and then you'll have a sick emoji to get you better.
Like, I think emojis are really powerful and really interesting, because I think that people use them to express things that, it's not like an abbreviation where, like, oh, I would use this whole word, but instead I'm using, like, a picture. Like, I think we're actually expressing something that is, like, more than the image and that we all semi-mutually understand. So the idea of using something that's that intuitive and that sort of interpretive is, like, really interesting in the context of magic and witchcraft.
That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, I think that's, I don't know, I read an article not too long ago, you know, predicting the doom of millennials, you know, all of our language being erased and replaced by these emoji symbols that people are texting with these days, kids these days. And, you know, I just thought that was really hilarious and amazing. Like, we've always used images to communicate as a species, you know? And
literally longer than we've used words, like,
yeah. Pictograms, paintings, yeah, on cave walls, you know, like all that kind of stuff. So, I think stuff like that is really funny, and subverting that doom and gloom about technology is, like, one of my favorite things, because I love technology. It's not doomy and gloomy.
And maybe it can be doom, like, in a good way, like doom to the status quo and doom to capitalism and doom to patriarchy.
Correct.
Which I feel like is kind of the theme. A Resistor is really interesting. It's an interesting collection because a lot of the fiction in it is very, like, dystopic. And that, and, like, there's technology connected to that, but technology is also, like, theoretically a viable means of liberation. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, I'm a big personal believer. Like, I love William Gibson, and, like, one of William Gibson's most famous quotes is, you know, all the technology is here, it's just not equally accessible yet. And I think that speaks a lot to, like, how we use technology, like the class separation for technology, like who has access to what. and what level of wellness, what level of health insurance, like whatever. Like, so we're in a dystopia. Like, I think that we are in the cyberpunk dystopia now. Like, we have implants inside of us. We have personal technology devices that we carry around all the time that we can talk to people millions of miles away on, right? Yeah, I think that when you're talking about using technology to fight the status quo, like, you can use all of that stuff powerfully because we are in the dystopia.
And, like, those are the tools we've got, right? And, like, as someone with an IUD, I'm a real believer in, like, medical science and its wonders. Like,
me too.
Its ability to, like, nice.
Yeah.
IUD pals. And, like, its ability to, like, genuinely, like, materially improve people's lives, you know?
Yeah.
I feel like embracing technology actually allows us to question, like, where does the dystopia actually come from? What is the actual vector of, like, or means or medium of oppression?
Yeah, I mean, because you think about systems, right? And really, that's a powerful metaphor when you're talking about technology, because a lot of, you know, you think of computers, like, what makes computers work? It's the programming in the system. And that's the same thing with, like, our cultural systems, like, and, you know, we have some pretty good cultural systems now compared to in the past, but, right.
Like, we could do worse. Yeah.
We could do worse. We could definitely do better. And I see us struggling at doing better all the time. You know, that's why hacking the system is such a potent social justice metaphor, because what you're doing is finding weaknesses in the system and then finding ways to navigate through that system successfully as a person who might be oppressed or discriminated against.
So that interests me as people who engage with, like, analog games and who play LARPs and freeforms and whatever, because they are systems, right? Like, games are systems. And so if you're sitting down to make a game, I feel like you're being like, time to exert some power over how people think and act. Do you think about it that way, or are you just like, this would be fun?
Oh, totally. No, there is a ton of meta happening. I think in my game design in general, because I am so interested in things like systemic oppression and game design. Like, I don't know, it's a weird intersection when you start breaking it down. It's not that weird. A lot of people have done it before. But I think it's really powerful to kind of examine how game systems work and the elements that you can manipulate to tell different stories or elicit certain responses, right? So it is kind of like a programming, it is cyborgian. Have you ever read Donna Haraway's Cyborg Manifesto?
Yeah, it talks about, like, the cyborg as, like, androgen and, like, a very, like, in terms of trans-inclusive feminism, like, in terms of talking about feminism in the way that, like, isn't terrible to trans people as it totally has been in the past, the concept of being a cyborg and, like, resisting the natural and the naturalistic fallacy is, like, really powerful, actually. Like, the idea that, like, physically, like, altering and changing and using technology in that way isn't, like, disrupting some sort of natural order. It can be, yeah, it can actually make you who, or, like, help you be who you actually are. Oh, man, I'm rambling a lot this episode, for God's sake.
No, it's great. That was wonderful and perfect. That is the essence behind the Cyborg Manifesto, right? And that's my one beef with Fury Road, actually, is that they are so heavy on the goddess feminism and kind of like the white feminism.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, you know, death to the good kind of feminist, like, death to the non-inclusive, non-intersectional feminist.
Which is the non-threatening feminist, right? Like,
yeah.
Don't worry, 99% of your status quo is going to be fine. I'm only just going to change this one little part.
Yeah. Totally. And, like, as a white queer feminist, right, like, I'm trying to lift up as many other voices as I can and do the best I can from my place of privilege. And that's, I think, really hard for a lot of people to do, is kind of, like, set that aside sometimes and allow other people to speak. And that's part of what our mission was, Alyssa and my mission for Resistor, was to collaborate with other non white het cis men, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's not, like, a better way of saying that.
Yep.
To be trans inclusive, lady inclusive, person of color inclusive, and to try and highlight their stories in games and art for the different issues.
Which you actually have an entire game about, a nice little nano game in Resistor. It's this amazing sort of, like, meditative, deliberate, like, intentional magic ritual about promoting the voices of people who have less of a voice voice than you do, or have less of an audience than you do. It's not subtle, that game. I like it.
Yeah, awesome.
Did it start out as more of a metaphor, and then you were like, no, I'm just going to make people do the legitimately good thing?
Yeah, no, I mean, because I think that, you know, magic and technology are both tools to accomplish things in the world. That's what's cool about putting them both together, because they're both basically the same thing. Yeah. I had read this article, actually, for that game, for Signal, that was talking about global feminism, and a lot of feminist stuff that we see, especially, like, even in America or on social media, is, like, very American white-centric. And so, like, the idea of, like, looking outside of your personal sphere or, like, you know, your circles or whatever, the things that you're seeing, and, like, deliberately search out different people's stories so that you can actually learn what's going on in the world and have, like, a perspective, which is really healing and very connecting, like, when you can, I think, learn and reach out and connect to other people and tell their stories or help them tell their stories, ultimately.
Yeah, exactly. Not the sort of imperial mode of a weird kind of feminism, which is like, hey, what's up, guys? Time to fix you.
Yeah. You're not like that guy. What was that guy's name who, like, went down to New Orleans, the CNN reporter? Like,
what?
You know that guy?
Tell the story. I didn't know the story.
Oh, never mind. It's, like, a long time ago. I can't remember his name. He's, like, a famous reporter who, like, goes into other countries and is, like, oh, white guilt. And I don't know. He's just terrible. Oh, no. Not like that. Don't do that.
Yeah, I want to follow up on what you said about technology and magic being pretty much functionally the same. I wonder, like, the mystical and the digital, like, are they just very similar? Are you trying to fuse them? Are you trying to compare and contrast? Like, what is your intention when like, in a lot of your work, you meld those two themes together?
That's interesting. I guess that's true. I mean, I think that the intention behind it is actually ironic, like, to demystify technology. Mm-hmm. Because there's so much stuff about technology now that is negative, you know? Like, almost all sci-fi is robots are terrible and evil and coming to destroy us. Be afraid, you know?
Yeah.
That's awesome, like, the first 100 times, but
it's very fun, it's very frightening, but yeah, where does it get us?
Yeah, and I don't think that it's good to fear the tools that we have. Like, if you have access to technology, you should utilize it. And I think that a lot of people similarly are afraid of magic. Like, magic is, like, this taboo thing, you know, not as far as, like, religion or spirituality, but, like, pagan magic or root magic or hex magic or, you know, stuff that is old or subversive or supposed to be liminal. Kind of the same way. Why be afraid of that? Like, look, they're just so similar. Like, looking at those two things, making them work together is, like, really interesting, because you can kind of take, like, those two fears and, like, examine them and kind of subvert that and turn it around. Like, why are you afraid of this? This is actually awesome. Look at the freedom this can give you, or the thoughts you can kind of explore by delving into these supposed darker paths.
And these supposed opposites, because I feel like a lot of people who are really down with magic and with ritual are sometimes technophobic. And I feel like a lot of super intense tech people can be very, anti-theist or anti-spiritual or anti-magical. So I don't know. Are you offering, like, a third path? Are you trying to make those two groups butt heads or confront what their assumptions?
I don't know. All of those things.
They're all good. I mean, you know, take your
pick. Yeah. No, I actually think it is a third path. And it's not really just me offering it. I mean, there's a huge community of techno-pagans online, and in various queer, trans, and multiracial communities. Like, I'm actually a part of a Facebook group called Queer Witches. It's private. It's like a private queer witchy group. But it's got, like, thousands of people in it from all over the world. And it's really interesting because there's so many politics in that group. Like, the magic there is kind of about, partially about identity politics. And talking about, like, you know, my ancestors were white. Should I be doing root magic? Do African gods care about me? Like, and kind of discussing that through an online forum. And I've seen a lot of techno magic, you know, like on Tumblr and stuff. There's a woman, I can't remember her name, but she recently has created a series of techno hexes. And the most famous one was a hex for straight people, that if you aren't nice to trans people, then you're cursed. And she just put them up. They're awesome. Like, I will send you the link. She put them up, like, all over town. And if you look at the image, you're cursed if you hate trans people. And it's
see, that's amazing. Yeah, that's powerful. I feel like almost all the witches that I know are queer. What is it about magic, do you think, that really appeals to... Is there something specifically queer about magic?
Well, it's both those things. There's actually a history of queerness in magic. I don't know how much you might know about it. But
no, please elucidate.
Yeah, there's books upon books of gender transgression for shamans and other magic users in tribal communities in particular, which is where kind of a lot of what we think of as contemporary magic comes from. Like, it is more or less tribal stuff, you know, from those practices. Yeah, I think it also contemporarily has to do with style. I mean, a lot of magic is seen as, you know, magic isn't a real religion. It's not Christian. It's not Muslim. It's not Judaism. It's not it's not one of the top three. So it is in and of itself kind of subversive to practice magic in a lot of different cultures, Western cultures that I know of. I mean, it might be totally different in some Eastern situations that I just have no idea. So yeah, I think that it's those two things. And maybe the craft, you know, in the 90s.
Well, you know, magic is very often about, like, feminine power, right? Which is not the type of power that we're kind of taught to expect and want and value. So I think that alone is, like, pretty potent. And I think anyone who's going through any kind of, like, questioning gender stuff is going to go, like, oh, this feminine power... Do tell. Do go on.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point. There's some books you can read about queer feminist history, like goddess worship too, and like the queer witch, basically like in the 70s and 80s. And so like a lot of our current concepts of that comes from that history that wasn't actually too long ago of this idea of like the queer woman witch or the trans woman witch.
Yeah. And there, I mean, I feel like witch also in like Western history is also associated with like dangerous person, outcast, person who's messing things up. And so I think, yeah, is there something empowering about reclaiming that identity is like, actually, it's rad to be that person.
Oh, totally. I mean, I was one of the people who read the witch movies, Feminist Doctrine, right? Like, I don't know if you saw that, but...
I'm too scared to watch horror movies, but I'm told, and I believe...
Okay. So no, this won't spoil it for you.
Oh, no. Go to town.
Cool.
Spoilers, listeners.
Yeah, spoilers for The Witch that came out a few months ago. Yeah, so at the end, you know, it's basically the story of a Christian family who is too proud to live as part of a community, so goes out to live by a forest by a witch. And then the destruction of that status quo, basically, of like, this is what a family should look like. And the witch is the metaphor that destroys that, the Christian family, basically.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that that is a really, and it's really good social commentary right now, right? Because the idea of the queer or liminal witch or the woman who is the outsider having to live with the status quo. And then it's kind of like a fantasy to be able to destroy it. Right.
Yeah, totally. Right. Like it's totally a fantasy to be like all these people who think that I'm out to destroy the concept of family and the concept of marriage. Like, I think I will do that. Actually, that would be great.
Right? I'll build it up.
I wish I had the power you apparently think I have.
Yeah. I mean, that's bananas that's like in American history, you know, that's what happened, you know, up in the New England woods, that there was such a fear of women among the religious up there that they just used to kill them. And I mean, it's not that different now. I was just watching a Vice, you know, it's a Vice, but a documentary, I think it was on Afghanistan women, and just like what the hell is going on over there, and how they're fighting so hard for rights, like, and they're driving around with this one woman in a car, and she's like, I am just so happy that I can drive. It's a huge freedom. And, you know, women getting stoned in the street. Like, it's just fucking crazy. So, you know, it's not like that doesn't exist now. It still does.
I feel like the witch remains probably a potent metaphor for that reason. Like, there's still stuff that we want to wreck and, like, ruin and destroy. In a lot of Wiccans that I've spoken to, they're like, oh, no, I'm a white witch. And it's all about, like, healing and, like, mending and, like, helping. But, like, I don't know. Do you think there's a place for like a for like the dark magic and for destruction and for like fucking shit up? I don't know. What's your take? What's your take on fucking shit up?
Yeah, 100%. So this is really interesting. Yes, fuck shit up. 100%. Yes. Mm. The idea, there's a lot of talk about this in pagan communities. Like, I don't even know if Wiccan is the right word anymore. Like, I was Wiccan when I was 15, you know, like 20 years ago. And now I'm just kind of like, I don't know what any
question mark.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I just don't know what any of it means anymore, which is part of why I'm paying so much attention to what people are saying online, you know, because it's very complicated. Like the idea of Wiccan, of the witch in America is very white. It comes from a lot of, you know, European ancestral stuff like the Vikings and Celtic mythology. And, you know, I think that modern contemporary witches in America are trying to be more aware, more inclusive. So you have people from different backgrounds, from like root working backgrounds in like African tradition, or people who are doing voodoo or Haitian stuff or Cuban things, you know, to kind of integrate more and just kind of have a global understanding of paganism, which is really, really super interesting to me. Like, I feel like we're entering a new age of pagan practice, which is going to be pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely. And I've seen like people I know who are into shamanism. I feel like we're also seeing this kind of like people from thousands of different disparate shamanist traditions or like shamanistic traditions, like talking to each other and being like, you guys do that? We do that. Yeah. And that, I feel like that brings us back to communication technologies and the internet, yep. Right? Like in what way does the internet almost inherently serve the average witch?
Yeah. Well, it used to be like, you know, white guy researchers like going around in different tribes and like writing down like, oh, everybody worships snakes. This must be a connection, you know? but now anybody can have that conversation. It doesn't have to be some academic who's getting paid money with an agenda. Like, you can just have conversations with people. And I think that the opportunity for discovery there is way huger than any kind of stuff that we were dealing with in the past. Like the idea of learning about syncretic religions, what people practice, why they practice it, being more careful and culturally aware not to colonize any other people's beliefs while still practicing them respectfully, I think is, you know, a big deal.
Because the danger of reaching out and being like, hey, all of our traditions are really have all this common ground, like the danger is in then like homogenizing and being like, there is one, you know, and we're all doing pretty much the same thing, and just ignore all those differences. Like, I don't know, how do you walk that line?
Yeah, no, I think I don't know, that's I think that everybody will probably always retain their cultural practices, you know. When you're looking at spiritual practices, I don't know, I grew up in Philadelphia, and there's a lot of Native American history there, and a lot of Native American people are still there. And so going to drum circles, Native American drum circles, festivals, powwows, heat lodges, stuff like that were, you know, pretty common practice. But, you know, when you go to them, it'd be mostly white people. Yeah. And it'd be, you know, the Native Americans were there, but it was just such a blatant example of like our historical colonialism, like what happened here in Philadelphia, what happened in America. But they're still, you know, practicing their traditions and teaching them in order to preserve them and in order to preserve respect for them. And so I think it's really complicated.
Yeah. Yep.
Because, you know, in some cases, they do want people to practice their stuff.
Yeah, and also, like, you can't necessarily tell from a distance whether or not someone is of any particular ethnic background, right? Like, I have a good friend who is Aboriginal and, like, really connected with other women at this, like, women's Native Center, Minwashin, here in Ottawa. But, like, she has, like, red hair and bright blue eyes because, you know, her mom's Irish or whatever. And so, you know, that means that she has a lot of privilege that like people who are more visibly Aboriginal don't have. But it also means that like, I don't know, like when she was first kind of realizing it and like studying her father's kind of like background and figuring it out, she was, the people that she spoke to were like, well, you know, if we kicked out everyone who didn't like fit the stereotypical like Aboriginal appearance, then there would be none, there wouldn't be very many people here. So we're kind of just like, whoever shows an interest and like wants to respectfully like engage, we should just engage. I don't know. That was that one person's perspective.
Yeah. I think that that is sometimes a common perspective. And I mean, I've heard that perspective too from, Native Americans in Philly anyway, that I learned a lot of stuff from, and voodoo practitioners in Philly, you know, like I know people who have, who are, Latino, who have learned, voodoo practices from Italian women. It's, I think it's really complicated. I mean, we have a complicated race situation in America, and when it comes down to cultural practices of magic, it is, deeply tied to, you know, your race, your culture, your identity. So I think it's difficult. And that's where, you know, the internet is like magic, right? Because it has all this information that you can find out and perspective that you can talk to a certain amount of people and like learn this stuff about instead of just kind of being in your silo wherever you are.
Yeah. And like you were saying earlier, like not just learn about these things through the sort of like the mediator of a publisher, an academic, and whatever, but like talk to people who do it and be like, what's your take?
Yeah, totally.
How do you feel about this?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up reading like Llewellyn and Aleister Crowley, and, you know, I hung out, I went to like New Hope, which was like the big witchy place near where I lived. And it's like famous. There's like a lot of famous witches that live there. They're all white, you know, like they would have pagan get togethers. They were mostly white. And that's still true. Like pagan conventions in America, do have a race problem, and they're working on it, you know, kind of like game conventions.
Kind of like game conventions is exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I mean, I really like when people can bring perspectives and lessons and like experiences from other communities into gaming communities. What kind of insights from like getting involved with paganism and witchcraft are you bringing to the gaming community?
Sure. Gosh, I don't know. I think that there's already been some work done in game communities, actually, with things like ideas that circle around ritual. So like ritual phases, the idea of like setting a ritual space when you sit down at a table to play a game. Meg Baker has done a ton of ritual stuff that's really cool. Yeah, I don't know. From pagan communities, might not be the best example because like I don't really like, I haven't been in too many pagan communities that I've liked.
That's funny. I could say almost the same thing about gaming communities. Yeah. It's like when it's good, it's so good. Yeah. And when it's not good, it's so not good.
Yeah. No, it's really true. I think that, I don't know, from pagan communities, you know, I think the best parts of pagan communities are just being open to experiences and being able to learn. You know, translating that to gaming communities, I think is pretty cool. Like if you can enter into a space, thinking, you know, like I could learn from any of the people here, you know, having an open mind about stuff, I think is really important in gaming spaces.
Yeah, totally. And are you bringing that mindset when you go to a LARP? Is it the same mindset of just like, well, this is going to be what it is and we'll see how it goes?
Right. And like, you don't have to control the story or power game or, you know, yeah, no, I actually think that that is a good thing to keep in mind for gaming spaces too.
And what kind of ways does that manifest, right? Because that sounds like the opposite of the sort of like rules lawyery, like I must have narrative control for this time and like player agency and a lot of those ideas that come out in game design. It seems kind of counter to that, to just be like open to what happens. I don't know. Do you think there's a contradiction there, or do you think that like you're all after the same thing?
That's really interesting, because I think what's the popular story gaming Nordic LARP thing, right? Play to lose. You know, play with not the intent to win, which is I think a historical gaming thing to do. Like, I need to be the best and win at every role and never fail it. Be the ultimate awesome hero. And instead of just kind of going in with what is this game about? What kind of story can we tell? How can I help other people tell their stories too? That kind of thing I think is really good.
Yeah. Do you think, I know magic can be very healing. Do you think that gaming can be healing?
Oh, 100%. Yes.
Please elaborate. Has it been healing for you in your life?
Yeah, totally. Probably one of the most poignant examples. I've had tons of healing in game. I've learned so much from gaming. It's ridiculous.
Oh my gosh. Do go on.
Yeah. I mean, like, I've learned, like, how to run better meetings by being a game master.
Same.
Oh, my God.
Same.
Right? Like, how to organize five grumpy, difficult people in a convention for 4 hours. Like, that's hard.
Public speaking, right? Like, yeah. I'm such a much, much better public speaker than I was before I started LARPing, for sure.
Same. Yeah, you kind of learn how to interact with people, talk to, how to form a conversation better, I think. And be creative spontaneously, which used to be a little harder for me, actually.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, because the question for me is, like, do you learn those things through LARPing, or is it just the people who have those skills who really like to LARP?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it's both. Like, I think that a good LARP will be designed. It'll have a well-designed system that will guide you through the steps of all of that, right? Like, the things that you could potentially learn. I think that the game that maybe I learned the most from was Mad About the Boy, the LARP.
I would love to chat with you about that experience because it sounded really, really interesting. So this is the LARP. This is like a Nordic LARP kind of based on, like, vaguely but not officially, Why the Last Man, which is the comic book series in which every one with an X chromosome on the Earth dies.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone has a Y chromosome on Earth dies, except for this one guy. Tell me about that experience. What was that like?
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, it's a little problematic. You know, gender isn't determined by chromosomes. Yeah. I'm just gonna throw that out there. You know, and you know, rightly, a few trans people were upset about that. But there are trans people in the game that were cool with it. But both sides are fair, I think. So it's a conceit. But I think that the thing that was coolest about that was just being in a game with, I think we had 40 women total, like, out in the woods, and we were basically in charge of the world. Like, we were the last people on Earth, and we had to make important decisions for humanity. And I had never played a game like that before, where being a woman was the norm, first of all. That wasn't even a question. And that everybody assumed competence, respect, you know, things that are unusual in the world itself, actually. and it was a really powerful experience. Like, that, despite, like, all the problematic elements of that game, I would run it or play it again in a heartbeat if I had the chance, because that experience in and of itself, I feel like every person who identifies as a woman should have the chance to feel that.
It sounds like operating in that mode where you are just competent and just assumed to be competent and you make decisions for other people and are respected for that. Is that something that then kind of got to, you know, for lack of a better word, bleed over into your real life? Were you able to kind of take that with you and put that in your pocket?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah, it gave me a lot of confidence, actually. I remember when I first got off the plane and I was walking in the airport, and this is, like, so funny because, like, I have been a feminist all of my life, but you know how, like, you kind of go through, I don't know if you do, but many people go through stages of feminism where they kind of, like, the veil becomes more and more removed.
You start to see the matrix. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, as you go, you're like, oh, I don't have to be a tomboy anymore. I don't have to hate other women anymore. Yes. You know, women are cool, actually. I don't have all dude friends. Yeah. And, like, you know, just, like, all those stages.
I don't have to compete with women.
Totally. And I mean, I think to some extent, I'm still, you know, I have many stages to go. But
well, we all have internalized misogyny, right? Like, we all grew up in this garbage culture. It takes time, you know.
Yep, totally garbage.
We've got to work with ourselves. Sorry, not to cut you off. Keep going.
No, that's really true and a really good point to make about internalized misogyny. Because that's really hard to beat. Ultimately, you're fighting yourself. And that's hard. I was, like, looking at men and women differently, like, in the airport. And I was, like just looking at women and being, like, I noticed more women around me suddenly. And it was, like, a really epic shift. Like, I don't know why I hadn't noticed women that way before. But I did. And it was really cool because it was a lot of women in games and game design. So, like, we became a network and we suddenly knew who we all were. And so in the American gaming community, that's a big deal because women are still underrepresented, I think. And so for us to, like, make those ties and connections in a game was super huge.
Yeah, I never thought about it on that just kind of practical level.
Yeah.
It just connected a lot of people because, you know, in gaming in general, it's still such a niche thing that you feel really, like, disconnected from, I think, a lot of other people. And, like, because role-playing is, like, so in-person and so live, you can kind of get, like, you know, trapped in, like, a very tiny, like, local scene. I mean, you're in New York, so you have a gigantic local scene. But, like, but still, like, it's very regional. So, yeah, I mean, what kinds of things do you learn when you are able to connect with other people and, like, and specifically other women who are into this kind of weird thing that we like?
Sure. Yeah. No. Well, first of all, I'm not in New York, actually. I'm in Ohio.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
God, I don't know why I put you in New York. I guess because I see you at the New Jersey conventions all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I just assume everyone there is from New York.
I mean, they kind of are, to be fair. Like New York and Philly. And I'm originally from Philadelphia. So yeah, no, I fly a lot for work. So I get to travel for work, and then I can sometimes tack on a convention, which is why I end up at Metatopia sometimes.
Nice.
Yeah. But I think, what was your question? How to connect with other women?
Yeah. Yeah. What happens, and what about your game design, and what about your play changes when you're able to connect with a broader group of other gamers?
Gosh, it's so important. I mean, like, I think that it doesn't happen accidentally. You have to, like, intentionally make that happen. Like, I'm intentionally reaching out to women to play a game with me, or I'm going to run this game for my local ladies, even if they're not all gamers. Like, maybe there'll be one or two new ones, and that kind of thing, because creating those spaces then grows the larger community, and you are able to kind of be like you said, like, I'm not isolated, I'm not alone, there's other people like me in this community, and here they are. So it's, I mean, I think that that's really important to find your, what's it called? When you have like an affinity group within a larger group, because then, you have similar stories, you can get support or consolation if you need it. And I think that's a big deal, especially for a lot of women in the industry. Like, I actually saw that you're on the Gen Con.
That got announced today. Oh, that's so exciting.
Yeah, that's really awesome. Gen Con Industry Insiders, right?
Industry Insider featured presenter. Dang. More words, more prestige.
Fancy. Yeah, I mean, that's awesome. Like, having that visibility, having women in leadership roles or visible roles, is a huge deal. It tells another woman in the room, hey, that could be me. Or, you know, that woman is respected. I could be respected that way too. And so, yeah, I mean, that stuff is huge.
Yeah. And I think for a lot of us, like, there's certain things that it's like, in order to engage with this hobby in a way that I want to, I'm going to have to put up with A, B, C, or D. You know, and we all just kind of went like, whatever, there's going to be that one gross guy and this one guy who says this and one guy who says that. And yeah, I think part of the advantage of, like, first of all, gaming with all other women, when you see what that's like, and, like, actually holding people to making people responsible for what they do and say, makes you go like, oh, wait, I can actually not have those things. That's appealing.
Sure. Yeah. And you can find ways to work together as a group to fight it, right? So yeah.
Yeah.
Back to hexing.
Yeah, exactly.
That makes me want to write a hex for gaming conventions.
That would be great, actually. Some sort of just like sigil of protection that I could keep on me would be really handy.
Hey, getting ideas for the next issue.
Just a sigil against the various haters, you know?
Sigil against the various haters. Yes.
So, what's the next convention that you're going to? When am I going to get to hang out with you again?
Well, I'm helping organize Games on Demand at Origins. So,
right. Tell me about working at Origins, because it's actually a convention I've never been to.
Yeah.
And I hear such good things, and I see people getting so excited for it. Tell me about Origins. What do you like about Origins?
I love Origins. I've been going to Origins since I was a baby, like a very young gamer. Yeah. Like, not an actual baby, but like, yeah, like as a teenager, like I was 16, and like, you know, me and my mom and like my boyfriend and his friends and my brother, you know, like we drove out from Philly to go to Origins.
That's so legit that your mom brought you to Origins.
Yeah, my mom actually got me into gaming. She
really? Yeah. Okay, stop everything else. Tell me that story.
She's not a gamer, but she knew that I was. Like, I played video games all the time, and she's like, hey, Kira, maybe to get you more social, you could play these social games.
get off the computer. Is that what it was? Because I remember hearing that a few times. Yep.
That is 100% what it was.
Did she have, like, did she specifically, like, here's D&D? Or, like, what were you playing as a teen?
Oh, so I got, I think the first game I got was Vampire, because I found it in a hobby store. Because my dad used to go to hobby stores all the time. And I'm like, what is this? And then it was in Hot Topic, and, you know, I was goth, and so I was like, okay.
Of course.
Yeah. So, so I got into Vampire, and so what my mom took me to was, like, I tried to play D&D at Origins. It was terrible. So then I saw there was a Vampire LARP, and I was like, what is this? Costuming? Yeah.
Everyone. Everyone was a Vampire LARPer in the 90s. Yeah. Everyone on Earth.
Yeah.
I love when I get to the point where I know someone well enough that they finally reveal to me that they were a Vampire LARPer in the 90s. This is, like, a crucial, crucial point.
I mean, I'm not embarrassed about it. It was ridiculous. Good. I still think it's ridiculous. But I played White Wolf for, like, I don't know, 15 years? Like, a long time. Like, White Wolf games. Yeah, and they were formative. I mean, it was super fun being emo creatures of the night.
Yeah.
For a long
time. Well, that's the thing. But, like, being a teenager, it's like, I'm miserable and I can't get along with people. I might as well, like, make a game out of it.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Might as well have fun.
Yeah.
Make it cool in my mind.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what was your experience of, like, Vampire LARPing as a teen? Like, was that a good social outlet for you? Was it, like, not worth the price of admission or?
Oh, it was 100%. Yeah, it was a great social outlet. I mean, it had its problems, right? Like, I don't know. Vampire is a problematic game because ultimately it's, like, kind of rapey.
Yeah.
And so you put a lot of older guys in a room with, like, hot teenagers, and it's kind of like game over sometimes.
Yikes.
Yeah, so there were bad experiences, but there are also amazing experiences. Like, I actually got into the Philly goth scene because, you know, a lot of the people in charge of the Philly goth scene used to play Vampire LARPs, so we'd play the games with them, and then they were like, hey, you should come to our cool club, and we were like, okay. And then we were, like, vampires in real life.
The dream.
Yeah. And, you know, through goth clubbing, like, I went to art school. So, like, all that kind of, like, intersected, like, the different communities that I was in. And I got into the kink scene. Like, I met people who were vampires in the kink scene. Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. A lot of crossover there. I can't believe, every time I'm like, more, eh? More. All around us. All of us, apparently.
I mean, I'm a huge fan of the idea that kink and gaming is basically the same thing.
They're basically the same thing. You agree for, like, just for now, just for this one, like, separate apart time, I'm going to take on this role that is very different from my normal life. Like, it's literally not different at all.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Because I find that, like, the kink community has, like, a lot of interesting, like, norms and practices and, like, terminology that's really useful for gaming. Mm-hmm. Are you adapting that? Are you adapting, like, kink experiences or, like, modes of thought in your design?
Totally, yes. I mean, like, I'm a huge proponent of consent, obviously, and negotiation. And I think that that is true in gaming, too. Like, you have to negotiate so much in gaming. It's like you're negotiating conversation, negotiating scenes. And that's a huge part of the kink world too. Like, okay, we're about to do a scene. What are your boundaries? I can't touch your arms and, you know, masks scare you. Cool. We won't do those things. Like, I feel like that conversation should be had at the beginning of games too. You know, we won't talk about these things in the game, but we can do other things.
Yeah.
And if it does come up, we have a safe word, like the X card, you know?
The X card is, yeah, totally the safe word of...
Yeah.
Yeah, of gaming.
Yeah, and I wrote a game, actually, Strict Machine, that I'm still making better.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but that is based on dirty talking.
Indeed it is.
Yeah.
I've read this game, even, and I was like, this is definitely a kinky game, but I'm having trouble identifying exactly why. Which I think is an accomplishment, really, if you could just sort of sneak that under the radar.
Yes. Yeah, but it's basically Dan Savage's rules of talking dirty. Like, say what you did, say what you're doing, or say what you're going to do, say what you're doing, and say what you just did. So,
oh, yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
I'm glad we both grew up on the Savage Love cast. Speaking of problematic, but
yeah,
ultimately probably helpful.
Yeah, I mean, still one of the best kink podcasts out there, despite some not so great stuff.
Like, reading Savage Love as a teen, I feel like I didn't have access to anyone else who was speaking frankly about fetishes and, like, kinks and, like, sex in general.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, even if I don't agree with everything Dan Savage says, it was at least nice to be able to be like, is anyone else... talking about this?
Yeah.
Like, is anyone else thinking about this ever? Yeah.
Yeah.
And in a way that would just like appear in your local newspaper, right? Your local alternative newspaper, I guess.
Yeah, no, it wasn't anywhere. And I actually still think that's true. I mean, we've got Mistress Matisse and, you know, a few poly in relationship anarchist people out there kind of talking about stuff. He's got old gay man syndrome where he's like, I'm still using the old guard words. No one can stop me. You know, like RuPaul, they're like trapped in the same world.
It's a generational thing, which is like such a queer thing, right? That like anyone 10 years older than us is just like completely incomprehensible.
Totally. Those queer kids these days using all kinds
what
of
are they saying?
Back in my day.
I wonder if we're ever going to see that kind of generational, or do we in fact see that kind of generational split in the gaming community? Like, I know we have our share of like disagreements in the community, and I wonder if a lot of that is just like mutual unintelligibility.
100%. Actually, so this is a weird example of this. I'm working on Blue Rose right now.
Oh, really? That's great.
Yeah, which I'm not like developing it or anything, but I'm just writing. I've written a few scenarios. I wrote about queer knights, and they they're ladies. Who mostly ladies who work in trios and are encouraged to be lovers over periods of time.
Amazing.
And ride griffins. I mean, it's ridiculous and amazing. Yeah.
Well, if you're in fantasy, you might as well fantasize.
Yeah. My feelings exactly. Mm. Yes. But I mean, Blue Rose came out in the 80s, I think. Like, it's an old game. And it was definitely like one of the first quote unquote queer games, you know, that came out that had like, oh my goodness, there's a gay character, in it type of thing. And as subversive as role-playing games have always been, like that was pretty progressive. And so I actually have people like, from an older generation who play Blue Rose, who just have kind of these older concepts about gender, sexuality, and queerness. And it's really interesting to see, like, I'm interested to see the finished product and where it ends up coming kind of from a different generation of people writing about queer romance.
Has that been like an educational thing for like you or them or like both to be like, oh, that's what you mean when you say this?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. It definitely has. Yeah. And I mean, I think having relationships with your queer elders is really important. You, for a lot of queer people, you also feel very separated, you know, like lady gamers, you're often like, there's nobody like me that I can look up to. Like, you know, I've got mm-hmm. Prince and David Bowie and that's it. And, you know, so if you have, you know, queer groups that you can join with older queer people in them, you learn so much about the history of where you come from. And that's super important.
Yeah, and I feel like queer history especially is like so easy to miss and so like easy to be lost because it's not like we hand it down directly, right? Like,
yeah.
Have you ever played in Just a Little Lovin' or I Say a Little Prayer?
No, but I really want to. Have
you? You'd love it. You would totally love it. I did Say a Little Prayer, which is the like 5-hour like mini version of it, but yeah, it was pretty amazing, like even in that. So a weekend of that would be pretty intense.
That's awesome. Yeah, I actually read that as inspiration for my mobilized LARP that I wrote about queer women in World War II.
Right. Yeah, you were involved in Warbirds, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell us about Warbirds and about mobilized specifically, I guess.
It's just organically going through all of my interests.
This is perfect.
Yeah. Yeah, Just 11, Say a Little Prayer. The main mechanic of the game is that you get a feather, and like sometimes if you get like a certain color feather, then you might have AIDS and die. I think that's how it works. I actually can't remember right now.
That sounds right to me, yeah.
Yeah, it's something like that. But it follows, you know, some gay men in the 80s, the HIV AIDS scare, which is absolutely terrifying moment in gay history. Like, it recently came up again when Hillary Clinton said something stupid.
Oh, yeah, what the fuck?
Yeah, I can't remember.
Yeah, that was basically, like, the Reagans weren't literally making it worse constantly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, they acknowledged that AIDS was a problem.
They when in started fact, a they, conversation, when in fact they did literally the opposite.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they waited until I think it was, like, 40,000 gay people in the U.S. had died.
Yeah.
And they're actually, if you look at the history, it's even more terrifying because we don't actually know, like, how many of those people were gay or straight, where they came from, like, what their health history was. It was just totally, totally bananas. And it just all came from this systemic oppression, the assumption that
the people who were dying of AIDS were gay.
And in some, like, weird, like, conservative, harsh way, just, like, deserved it. And that it was, like,
yeah,
punishment. Like, oh, my God, yeah, what a messed up time in American history.
Yeah.
Which is why you should make a LARP about it, so that we don't forget how fucked up it was.
Yeah, and, I mean, that's an intense LARP. I know I've posted it to, like, a few, like, queer groups, you know, queer gaming groups, and a lot of the older gay men are just like, I can't play that. That's just too close to home.
Which I respect.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, you know, super recent, important moment in gay history. When do you learn that in school? Never. Like, you don't really learn about that. You have to look up that information. And I didn't know anything. I didn't even know that there were queer people in World War II. Like, it had not even occurred to me, actually.
Right. Because where does that get written down? Where does that get taught?
Yeah, totally. I got this book. I was actually playing Night Witches, so it's Jason Morningstar's fault, partially. You know, I got really into women in World War II, and my boyfriend got me a book on it's called Coming Out Under Fire, and it's about gay men and women in World War II and real people and what they went through and their stories. And I learned from that book that queer women, primarily in the Army, in the Women's Army Corps in America, either became drill sergeants or car mechanics. I know, right? Like,
nice.
So I'm real into cars, so I went for the car mechanics. And
nice.
Yeah, my game Mobilize is just about five queer women in World War II in Atlanta, Georgia, who worked in a car fixing place that I can't remember the name of right now, at the fort. Mm-hmm. And the difficulties they dealt with kind of on a daily basis and how they built a community there. Because the main, the most important thing to come out of World War II was the civil rights movement, for queer people. Not the most important thing. I mean, it's good that we stopped the war too.
Stopped fascism and so on. Yes, but yeah.
but I didn't know that it was the first time that queer people in the U.S. were able to gather in different cities together and know each other. And so they started forming communities. The first women's lesbian magazine, zine, it's the first zine, was created. It's called, like, the Daughters of, I can't remember the name of it right now. But if you look up the first lesbian zine, that's what it is. So it's a super huge moment in American history for queer women to be able to kind of meet and talk in groups and form groups and then fight for civil rights. Basically because of World War II and, like, meeting in motor pools, you know? So, yeah, that's what the game is about.
And that's, yeah, again, that's such a special moment to capture and to allow people to, like, live. I mean, as someone who's making, or, you know, who made, like, a very, like, historically based game, like, what is the difference, or is there a difference between, like, reading history in a book or reading about it online versus, like, playing a game set in that time? Like, what are the advantages? What are the disadvantages?
It's a really good question. I think the advantages are that you can be closer to that situation and those people. You can kind of get into their head, walk a mile in their shoes type of thing. And I think that that leaves you with a more personal experience, which means you'll remember it, you know. Whereas I think absorbing history in other ways might not be as effective, to be honest. Like, I know that there's a lot of teaching LARPs and games, you know, designed to teach history. Like, I used to play video games when I was younger that, like, taught history. Where in the world is Carmen Sandiego? You know, I learned geography.
Oregon Trail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, I think that there is a lot of learning potential. Like, anybody that would play a historical game will remember, you know, who the queer women were in World War II, or who flew planes in Russia in World War II, you know, like, what they were like and their culture. So I think that's a huge deal. Writing a historical game is super stressful.
Of course. There's so much you have to get right. God, fantasy is so easy. Whatever I say is right is right.
Exactly.
Did you feel the pressure? Like, were you like, I don't know, describe that experience.
Oh, yeah, I procrastinated for so long in that game. Like, I'd get to a point and I'd be like, I'm writing the history of my queer predecessors. I can't fuck it up. Ah.
How do you deal with that? How do you turn that into something useful or productive?
for me, that just took time. Like, I think that mostly I had to get over my fear. That's the thing you have to get over every single time with making something. You just have to get over being afraid of it. And I think that some things I'm more afraid of than others, right? And so, like, it was something that held so much weight, that meant so much to me personally. Like, when I finished reading that book, I cried. You know, like, teaching people about queer history in America is such a big deal. And I hadn't realized kind of what I had taken on until, like, I got to that point, and I was like, oh, shit, this is a big deal. You know, and just kind of getting over the fact that it's not the last thing I'll ever write. It is perfect as it is. you know, that kind of thing. If you're scared of making something historical, that's okay. Go through the fear. Move through it. It'll get better.
That's, like, a really lovely note to end on, actually. I think we should end the episode on just... if something terrifies you, just keep making it. Just keep doing it.
That's my motto.
Well, if people want to, if our listeners want to hear more from you or keep up with what you're up to, where can they find you?
Sure. I am on Twitter. I'm Kira Nanzi on Twitter. I am on G+. I have a Tumblr that features a lot of my game design, and another Tumblr that's a mood board and is kind of sexy if you're into that. So all those links are, like, on my Twitter page, actually. It might be the best place to find them.
Perfect. Go to Twitter. Everyone should just go to Twitter. God, I love Twitter. Like, I feel like the whole thing we were talking about earlier about, like, just, like, connecting with people on, like, a very, like, personal, like, immediate, like, intimate level.
Yeah.
I feel like Twitter is just made for that.
Yeah. Yeah. Everyone wants to trash talk social media, and it is a super important connection tool in the contemporary age.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
There you go. There's a note to end on. Thank you very much for joining us. This is great.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, thanks again to Kira for coming on the show. And thank you for listening. Check the show notes for links to all of Kira's cool stuff on the internet. Remember that if you have questions or comments about something we talked about on the show, or you just want to reach out and say hi, you can do so via email, backstorypodcast@gmail.com, on Google+, @backstorypodcast, or on Twitter, @backstorycast. Backstory is part of the One Shot Podcast Network, which, thanks to all of our Patreon backers, just launched a new monthly show called Second Watch. Hosted by Megan Dornbrock of Modifier, Jim McClure of Talking Tabletop, and yours truly, just talking about what we've been making and playing and thinking about lately. It's a friendly chat for the most part, but, you know, the last episode got kind of real. So if you want a taste of my opinions on sex and religion in RPGs, you should probably listen. You can find Second Watch and all of the other great one-shot shows at oneshotpodcast.com. Music for Backstory is provided by Ujiko, and the track is called Thinking of You. You can hear more at soundcloud.com/Ujiko. Talk to you later, heroes.